You are listening to a sermon preached at the First Christian Church of St. Ignatius in St. Ignatius, Montana. For more information, you can visit us at www.firstchristiansti.org.
Well, good morning, everyone. Please turn to Job chapter 38. Might say we're working the short rows now when it comes to Job, huh? All right. Some of you may remember clear back to 1998. Who can remember 1998? Who was there for that? Some of you were not. All right. 1998, when a series of billboards started to appear along roadways in the United States. Now, they were quite simple, consisting of white letters on a black background. Each one displayed what was supposed to be a message from God. Here are some samples, though there were others as well. See if this works. Don't make me come down there. Let's meet at my house Sunday before the game. Love the wedding. Invite me to the marriage. Keep using my name in vain. I'll make rush hour longer. Will the road you are on get you to my place? Have you read my number one seller? There will be a test. We need to talk. My favorite here. What part of thou shalt not did you not understand? Come on over and bring the kids. Do you have any idea where you're going? Good for a billboard by the side of the road, right? You think it's hot here? Yeah. So do you need directions? That's also a good one for by the road. My way is the highway. Big Bang Theory? You got to be kidding. Like that one. Yeah, follow me, very simple, and also good on the highway there. I love you, and you, and you, and you. All right, that love thy neighbor thing, I meant that. And tell the kids I love them. All good stuff, right? Okay, and anybody else remember seeing those? Right? Okay, I don't know if they're even out there anymore. There's a couple over between here and Great Falls that I think somebody has put up, but not officially, you know. Anyway, they were supposed to be thought-provoking. I certainly hope that they started some people on their way to salvation in Jesus Christ. And while we might like to imagine hearing God say those things, how many of you think God personally put those billboards up by the side of the road, right? God came down and just, no, I don't think so either. Now, I'm not saying the idea for them couldn't have come from him. I'm just saying that he didn't stand there and dictate the sayings that were on those billboards. This was an ad campaign. An ad agency came up with these. And it wasn't as though God was standing there by the side of the road, stopping cars as they went by and saying, "What part of thou shalt not do you not understand?" Okay? Well, at this point, as always, you may be wondering why I'm telling you all this. As we have studied the book of Job so far, there has been several times when Job expressed a desire to have God respond to his complaints. In Job 31, verse 35, Job says it as plainly as he can. Let the Almighty answer me. But up to this point, there has been no response from God. Then we come to Job chapter 38. And in a be careful what you wish for moment, God does speak to Job. That's not to say that God gives Job all the answers he wanted. Matter of fact, we get to the end of the book and God never gives Job all the answers he wanted. Job had a lot of questions. Job had a lot of complaints. And God doesn't even address them. God did with Job what God does so many times with people. He told Job what he needed to hear and not what he wanted to hear. God's response to Job can be broken into three parts, and today we're going to look at the first part, which covers the first 38 verses of chapter 38, I think. And I call it, "Can you explain my creation?" This is God asking Job, and there may be, I'm sure there is, something for us in here as well. We'll start in Job chapter 38, verse 1. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now, gird up your loins like a man and I will ask you, and you instruct me. Now, as Elihu spoke in chapter 37, it seems that there was an actual storm brewing. It was getting closer. Here in chapter 38, verse 1, later in chapter 40, verse 6, we see God speaking to Job, first out of the whirlwind, and then it says out of the storm. And I think for Elihu, it was mission accomplished. I think he got Job's attention. I think he prepared Job to hear what God has to say. Because up to that point, until Elihu showed up, he wasn't really ready for that. But now he is, I think. But that's not to say that Job was entirely ready to hear what God had to say. Job seemed pretty convinced that he had the right outlook on his situation. But God's first words to Job, you wanted God to come talk to you, Job. Here's God talking to you. And his first words to Job are, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Not a description you want God to make of you, okay? Job was a righteous man, but he wasn't perfect in his understanding either of God or of his own situation. God then tells Job to prepare himself, and he's talking about mentally, but he uses a figure of speech that describes one preparing physically for an athletic activity or a contest, like maybe even a wrestling match, okay? Prepare yourself, Job. I'm going to take you to the mat. This isn't going to be pretty, I can tell you that right now. And why did God tell him to prepare himself? Well, Job has wanted to tell God all about how wrong God was in dealing with Job like he had. And God is going to give Job a chance to do just that. God tells Job that he will ask Job questions, and then Job can tell God how it is. You instruct me, he says. How many of you think that's what's going to happen, that Job is going to tell God how it is? Yeah, me either, okay? I don't think that's going to happen either. Of course, I've read to the end of the book, but so have you. Now, I told my class at school this week that I needed to issue a disclaimer regarding Job. I've been pretty hard on Job for how I believe he had gotten some things wrong about God's actions and motives. I hope no one here has gotten the idea that I believe that I would have done better than Job if I had been in Job's situation. Even though I do believe that Job got some things really wrong, I don't think I would have handled what happened to him half as well as he did. Having said that, I think we should move on. God's questions start in verse 4. Where were you? This is God speaking to Job, okay? And there's a lot of questions that God has. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who set its measurements, since you know? Or who stretched the line on it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. And I don't really talk about this in the rest of the message, but you'll notice here in the end of verse 4 and halfway through verse 5. Sounds like sarcasm to me, okay? If God is not above using sarcasm, maybe there's a place for it. But tell me, Job, if you have understanding, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Huh? Come on. I mean, who set its measurements? I know you know, right? Because you know all this stuff. You're going to instruct me. Well, okay, I think there's a little sarcasm here. But anyway, I'm not going to talk a lot about that. In verse 4, God begins questioning Job. And all of the questions have to do with the message title today. Can you explain my creation? God asked Job if he knows about the various aspects of the created universe. But God isn't just asking Job if he has technical knowledge of such things. God is asking Job not just about facts concerning the created universe, but about whether Job can explain how and why all of it came into existence. Because, you think about us today, we get pretty proud of how much knowledge we have about the world and all the things in it and how it all works. And then it comes down to, yeah, but how'd it get here? Oh, well, of course, it's just time and chance, it just arose out of nothing. I actually read a quote as I was preparing for the message, do a lot of my research online, and sometimes I get bogged down. I got to stop doing this. I get bogged down in forums where people are debating back and forth. And somebody said, in regard to the origins of the universe, somebody said something about in the beginning God. And, oh, yeah, that's just, I can't believe you're still holding on to that. And the rebuttal was, in the beginning there was nothing. And nothing expanded to create the universe and everything. I mean, literally, that's what it said. I can't believe that explanation. But anyway, the technical answers to some of these questions that God asked Job, the technical answers are easy. God says, Job, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Answer, I wasn't born yet, right? That's Job's answer. Your answer too, mine, but that could have been Job's answer. And that would have been right. God says, Job, who set the dimensions of the earth? Well, you did, God. That would have been the right answer. He's not asking for those answers, okay? Those answers would be true. But God is asking if Job was present at creation, advising God and instructing God about how to create. Here, God, let me show you how. I'll take you through this the first time since you've never done this before. Who's going to do that? Well, certainly not Job, not you or me either, but certainly not Job. Job would have to admit that he wasn't there, and he couldn't have advised God in any way in these matters, even if he had been there. And that sets the tone for everything that God has to say to Job in these three, four chapters. Okay? Go on to verse 8. Or who enclosed the sea with doors? When bursting forth, it went out from the womb. When I made a cloud its garment, and thick darkness its swaddling band, and I placed boundaries on it, and set a bolt and doors, and I said, thus far you shall come, but no farther. And here shall your proud waves stop. Genesis chapter 1. Verses 6 through 10, you're probably familiar, the creation account. In Genesis 1, 6 through 10, it says, Then God said, Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. God made the expanse and separated the waters which were below the expanse from the waters which were above the expanse. And it was so. God called the expanse heaven, and there was evening, and there was morning, a second day. Then God said, Let the waters below the heavens be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the gathering of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And so we have the Genesis account of how this came about, the thing that God was asking Job about. Job, how did these things take place? Well, Genesis it tells us all about it, right? Well, Job didn't have the benefit of reading Genesis chapter 1. Hadn't been written yet. But neither could Job claim any credit for either the knowledge of how the seas were formed and contained, or for the ability to form and contain the seas. Couldn't claim credit for either one of those things. Job could no more explain these things than he could cure himself or bring his children back to life. You think about that for a minute. Because these were the things that had been placed beyond his reach, as many things are. And as many things are in our lives, there are things just we can't control that. We can't explain that. We can't overcome it. And Job couldn't explain these things any more than he could take care of the problems that existed in his own life that were beyond his control. Go to verse 12. That's taken in this valley, I believe, that picture. God continues here in verse 12 to Job. Have you ever in your life commanded the morning and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? It is changed like clay under the seal, and they stand forth like a garment. From the wicked their light is withheld, and the uplifted arm is broken. Some confusing imagery in there, but let's see what we can do with that. And I think most of us here understand the process that creates the appearance of the sun rising and setting each day. We say that. We say the sun rises and the sun sets. Okay, it has that apparent motion, but that's not actually what's taking place, and I think you probably know why. As the earth rotates on its axis, we talked about the rotation on the axis being tilted a little bit last week, the part that is currently faced away from the sun moves eastward, okay, so the part that's in darkness moves eastward like we did last night. We were, you know, if you were up at 8 or 9 or 10 or whatever time the sun went down, if you were up at that time or later, you saw it was dark. We're moving eastward, okay? And then eventually the sun appears for us. It's over the mountains. And then it appears to move from east to west. And then this evening the sun will disappear back here over the hills, right? At what we call sunset. It's not the sun moving. It's the earth rotating. Now, I don't know whether Job understood that or not. But God wasn't asking Job to explain why we have sunrise and sunset. What did God ask? God asked Job if he had ever, in his entire lifetime, caused sunrise to happen. I don't care how much you know about sunrise and sunset. I don't care how much you know about the earth's motion and the sun and the orbits and everything else. I don't care how much you know about all that. How many of you have ever caused sunrise? No, you prayed for it sometimes, but you have not caused it, right? And neither had Job caused it. Neither had he caused any of the additional benefits the dawn brings. And God mentions some things here. The dawn, you know, at sunrise, in the evening, late evening and early morning, you see the land like you don't see it at any other time. Because of the way the light hits the hills, and you see the crevices and the valleys, and you see the three-dimensional aspects of it like you don't see it any other time of day. God makes mention of that here. And God also said that when the sun comes, and there's both a physical and a spiritual aspect to this, it causes the evil deeds of the wicked to be exposed. The wicked must either stop or be caught in their wickedness. If Job couldn't do something as simple, I use that word, as simple as to cause the sun to come up, how could he possibly instruct God in anything? I mean, that happens every day. We count on it happening every day. Sun's going to come up. Sun's going to go down. Sun's going to come up again the next day. We count on that happening, but we can't make it happen any more than Job could. Okay, on to verse 16. Have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you understood the expanse of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. And there's God again talking to Job as though Job were really going to be able to deliver answers to these questions. Now here's a question for you. Which is farther from sea level, the highest point on earth or the lowest point? Which is farther from sea level, the highest point on earth or the lowest point? The lowest, Gary says it's the lowest point. How many of you think Gary's right? A lot of you think Gary's right. Okay, some of you don't think Gary's right, apparently, or you're not paying attention. I don't know which it is. All right, so which is it? Highest or lowest point? Let's just talk about this. Probably many of you know that the peak of Mount Everest in the Himalayas is the highest point above sea level on Earth at just over 29,000 feet. Okay? That's a long ways up there. These mountains out here top out, what, not quite 11, a little over 10, something like that? Anyway, 29,000 feet above sea level. But the peak of Mount Everest is not the farthest place from sea level on Earth. Gary's correct. The bottom of the Mariana Trench, which is about 1,000 miles east of the northern tip of the Philippine Islands, is a little more than 36,000 feet below sea level. That's 6.8 miles straight down, okay? That's more than a mile, more than a mile lower than Mount Everest is tall, put it that way, okay? On March 26, 2012, a man named James Cameron reached the bottom of the Mariana Trench in a 24-foot submarine. Not me, man. The water pressure there is more than 1,000 times the air pressure that we experience at sea level. You know, there's a column of air above you. It exerts at sea level about 14.7 pounds per square inch of air pressure. Well, the water pressure there exerts more than 1,000 times that. And it's probable that the Mariana Trench and Mount Everest were both formed during the time of the flood. There are marine fossils at the peak of Mount Everest. And the mountain itself is formed of sedimentary layers that were likely laid down during Noah's flood. And we saw a video in chapel this week Dr. Jones brought to us that illustrated all that. And Now, Job didn't have a submarine in which he could explore the Mariana Trench, as far as we know. And even if he had, it wouldn't have invalidated the point that God is making. Job never had any part in establishing those depths or any other part of the vast earth on which we live. God is calling Job's attention to these things as if to say, hey, Job, take a look around you at the incredible vastness of the earth. How did all that come into being? Are you the one responsible for all this? No? Then what makes you think that you can straighten me out regarding your situation? God's speaking to Job, right? I know you want answers to explain your suffering, but what you need is a better understanding of who I, Creator God, really am. And again, God is addressing what Job needs to hear and not what Job wants to hear necessarily. Go on to verse 19. Where is the way to the dwelling of light? And darkness, where is its place? That you may take it to its territory, and that you may discern the path to its home. You know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow? Or have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the time of distress, for the day of war and battle? Where is the way that the light is divided, or the east wind scattered on the earth? There's a lot of things in that. I'm going to talk about light for a moment. Light and darkness are two of the most basic qualities present in our world. And darkness is merely the absence of light, right? But light is a bit more confusing. In physics terms, it has no rest mass. You don't have to remember all this, but I'm just going to tell you some things about light. Physics defines light in such a way as to say that it has no mass at rest. It's not matter in that way, but it does possess both energy and momentum. And light, by the way, if it's not in motion, isn't actually light. It behaves like a particle, but it also behaves like a wave. And most physicists believe that it behaves like both at the same time. Now, light travels at the speed of light. Yeah, I know, like the old dudge on, right? Okay. Which is what enables it to have energy and momentum without mass. Are you confused yet? I am. And then there's the difference between visible light and invisible light, some of either of which can be quite dangerous to our health and or well-being. As in the visible light produced by an arc welder, which can blind you if you look at that without proper protection, right? Or invisible ultraviolet light, which causes sunburn, skin cancer, and blindness. Light is powerful, too. We found out, in terms of its visibility, we found out in my classes last week, stuff you can find out reading Reader's Digest, right? We found out that a person with normal vision, I think, probably is what the assumption was, person with 20/20 vision, can see the flame of a candle under ideal conditions from 30 miles away. I didn't believe it when I heard that. I thought, no, Reader's Digest got it wrong. I had to look it up. Everything I've read says that's true. 30 miles away, light from a candle, right? Explain that, Job, huh? Yeah, explain that. Then God, okay, after that, talks about the light and the darkness. God also portrays himself as having storehouses full of snow and hail available for his use for whatever purpose. Is that literal? I don't think so. Okay. It's more like these things are so much under my control, Job, that it's like I've just got this big storage bin over here and I can just rake out the snow anytime I want it. I can just rake out the hail anytime I need it for whatever. And where were you in that, Job? Huh? What? What's that you say? Nothing? I'm not hearing you say anything, Job. That's because Job can't answer these questions. Even if Job understood the processes by which snow or hail are produced, he could not cause them to be made, nor could he control them for his own purposes. Let's go on to verse 25. Who has cleft a channel for the flood, or a way for the thunderbolt, to bring rain on land without people, on a desert without man in it, to satisfy the waste and desolate land, and to make the seeds of grass to sprout? Has the rain a father? Or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb has come the ice and the frost of heaven? Who has given it birth? Water becomes hard like stone, and the surface of the deep is imprisoned. Now, we talked quite a bit about water last week, including the way that water expands when it freezes, so it stays on the surface. That's what he's talking about here in verse 30. It's exactly what he's talking about in verse 30, that water, as it becomes a solid, doesn't contract like most things. It expands, and it floats, and it stays on top of the water, which is a good thing. But here's some other information about water. Now, when I was young, I remember watching ABC's Wide World of Sports on television. Anybody else ever watch Wide World of Sports? I don't even know if it's on anymore. Yeah, probably not. But Wide World of Sports. So maybe some of you can identify with this. I remember that they used to show cliff divers. And even if you haven't seen Wide World of Sports, if you've ever seen a cliff diver, you can visualize this. They used to show cliff divers diving into the water from as much as 85 feet up. Yeah, me either. Man, I don't want to get there. That's like being on top of an 8-story building, 85 feet, okay? I've read that there are professional show divers in Acapulco that dive from as high as 148 feet. That's like a 15-story building. And they dive and, you know, they're successful and they don't hurt themselves, right? Now, those cliff divers and show divers have to have perfect form in order not to injure themselves. They have to train. They have to have all the technique down because it's a very dangerous thing. At some height greater than 145 feet or with less than perfect form, probably less than 145 feet, injury is inevitable. Okay? Injury is inevitable. The problem is, I've read that jumping into water from 250 feet, don't ever do that. You don't want to. There's no reason to. Don't do it. Jumping into water from 250 feet is somewhere between 95 and 98% fatal. Don't go there. All right? Okay. The problem is that water, like other liquids, is not compressible. A person jumping off of a regular diving board isn't in much danger, even if he lands wrong, because he's not moving very fast. So when he hits the water moves out of the way quickly enough that it kind of cushions the fall and doesn't hurt him. So that it moves out of his way, he kind of sinks down into the water, but he doesn't get hurt. A person jumping from 250 feet hits the water going 126.5 feet per second. Now, we don't know how fast it is. That's 86 and a quarter miles per hour. Yeah, 86 and a quarter miles per hour, right? At that speed, water acts more like a solid. That's bad. Now, God doesn't talk to Job about diving or jumping into water, but he does talk about flood waters carving out channels as they move, and rain falling even where there's no human being present to directly benefit. I mean, what do we care if the rain falls out someplace where nobody lives, right? Oh, we care a lot. You think about what we're seeing on these mountains right now. You think about what we're seeing on these mountains right now with the snow, okay? Nobody lives up there, at least nobody in their right mind, right? Okay, but we want that to happen because what are we going to do next spring? Well, we're going to wait for that to melt and we'll receive the benefit of that snow that has fallen here. Man doesn't have the ability to bring these things about, even if he had the foresight to want to. Even if we think, you know, it'd be a good idea. It would be a really good idea if we make it snow up there right now and make it snow more and more and more. Nobody's up there. We don't care about, you know how much snow we pile up there. Let's just pile it full of snow. And then next year, next summer, we'll have all the water we need. And we're not going to have to worry about all those fires. Who's on board with that, right? We want to do that. We can't do that. You and I have this much control over that. Absolutely none, right? We come along after the fact, and we observe, and we learn, and we understand to a point, but none of us, including Job, could cause any of these natural phenomena. Go on to verse 31. Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades, or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth a constellation in its season, and guide the Bear with her satellites? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens or fix their rule over the earth? And there's a little echoing here, going on here. Job had talked about these very constellations early on in the speeches there. Okay, so it might have gone like this. Then God said to Job, there are the stars. Now, stars are pretty much, you know, we take them for granted. You go out and see them at the clear night. There they are. If there, you know, not enough light pollution. You can see a lot of stars out there. And we think we know a lot about the stars. Astronomers study and study and study, and they tell us all kinds of interesting things about the stars. Stars range in size from the neutron stars, which can be as little as 12 miles in diameter. Did you know there were stars that were only 12 miles big? Isn't that crazy? Right? All the way up to the supergiants, one of which at least, is about 2,100 times as large in diameter as our sun. Now, put it in numbers for you, okay? That makes that star 1.8 billion, with a B, 1.8 billion miles in diameter. Explain that, Job, huh? Yeah, okay? Or explain the three closest stars to Earth after our sun. There's Alpha Centauri A, Alpha Centauri B, and Proxima Centauri, all about 4.3 light years away from us, and all relatively close to each other. A and B are twin stars, which revolve around a common center of gravity about every 80 years. But we don't know whether Proxima Centauri is just passing through, or if it revolves around the other two. If it does, it takes 500,000 years for it to do it, says the astronomers. Okay, I love that part. Personally, I can't even fathom the idea of a star that is 1.8 billion miles in diameter, let alone explain its existence. And then there's comets, planets, nebulae, interstellar clouds, planetoids, and asteroids. You know, we used to think we knew how big the universe is. But this is our position now on that, according to NASA. According to NASA, all we can truly conclude is that the universe is much larger than the volume we can directly observe. We don't know how big the universe is. Guess who does? Yeah, okay. God knows, because he designed, created, and placed everything that exists in the universe. Okay, let's finish the chapter, starting verse 34. Can you lift up your voice to the clouds so that an abundance of water will cover you? Can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? Who has put wisdom in the innermost being or given understanding to the mind? Who can count the clouds by wisdom or tip the water jars of the heavens when the dust hardens into a mass and the clods stick together? Now, in the middle of that, in verse 36, which I don't really have a lot prepared to talk about here, that might even be something you want to go back and think about on your own. The rhetorical question God asked Job there in verse 36, who has put wisdom in the innermost being or given understanding to the mind? That really cuts to the chase, doesn't it? What do you know about anything? You might know a lot. You studied, some of you young people, you're in school, you're learning things, presumably. I mean, I hope that's true. And we older folks, I talked to somebody the other day, said, man, you got to learn something every day. It was I'll be polite, it was an older lady behind me in line at Walmart. And for some reason, we got into conversation and we were talking about that. And she says, you got to learn something every day. Good for her, okay? How is that possible? How are you able to do that? Why do you have that capacity? You come up with that on your own? Did you go buy that somewhere? Did you find it on the road lying around? How do you have the ability to learn anything or to know anything? Yeah, that may well cut to the chase, but now we're going to get back to clouds. We've talked about clouds before at some length. I'm not going to spend too much time on them now, but I would like to tell you about the clouds that are in the picture that is the backdrop for this slide, and I'll get the words and stuff out of the way so that you can see it. Aren't those cool? I mean, I don't know. Maybe you don't get too jazzed about clouds. I think those are pretty cool. Now, you've probably heard of cirrus clouds, stratus clouds, cumulus clouds, and others. Have you ever heard of undulatus aspiratus clouds? Yeah, me either, right? These clouds are formed when unstable rising air combines with wind shear to create what's called a gravity wave. Much like the ocean, low clouds caught in this flow create wavy structures. And you see that here. You see the wave. Okay. If you can see the picture at all, you can see that. Pilots will associate these clouds with turbulence and wind shear and will treat them with extreme caution. Interesting to me, This hasn't happened for 50 years, but back in March, a new cloud was added to the World Cloud Atlas. I don't know anything about that. I just know what I read. Anyway, undulatus aspiratus clouds were added only back in March and recognized now as a distinct cloud type. Now, I've got a short thing here, if it works, that shows what they look like in action. I believe this is time-lapse photography, so things are moving faster in the video here than they would in real life, but here's what I think that is looking like. And you can see and why they would call it that, the undulatus apparatus. It's undulating. It's like you're looking at the bottom of the ocean as the ocean waves are occurring. I mean, not the bottom of the ocean, looking at the surface from the bottom, from underneath. Okay, and you see those clouds doing this. Yeah, if you're a pilot, don't be in the air when that's happening. That's a bad thing. These clouds have been described by some as the kinds of clouds you expect to see on Judgment Day. I like that. I don't know if we will or not, but we certainly could. And if we do, it will be because God made it happen that way, and not Job, and not me, and not you. Which is pretty much the point of these 38 verses, isn't it? You can't do that. I can't do that. Job couldn't do that. God made that happen. So Job can't explain God's creation. Not to the point of having the ability to either imagine it in the first place. I mean, Job couldn't come up with that, nor could you or I. Job couldn't implement it. Oh, we've got this great idea. Let's create an earth. Okay, how do we do that? Well, we ask Job, because Job knows everything. No, Job doesn't know everything. And he doesn't know how to sustain it. The water cycle. Yeah, we study this from when we're in grade school, and we know all about it. We have no idea. We couldn't make that happen. It does happen by the power of God. And while nothing God has told Job so far answers Job's questions about the cause of his affliction and loss, because that's really what Job's focused on, and with good reason. I mean, again, I don't want to be too hard on Job. I would not have handled his situation as well as he did, I don't think. But God isn't telling him anything about that. And here's why, I think. Job's situation, while lamentable, it's not his biggest concern right now, according to God. What Job really needs is a greater understanding of who God is and who Job is relative to God. He needs to know that more than he needs to have answers for these other questions that he's got. Now, the next two sections of God's response to Job make much the same point, but from different perspectives. Regardless of our circumstances, we need to have a right understanding of who God is and who we are in relationship to him. And, you know, that makes a lot of other things far less important than we make them. Well, I got stuff to do. I got to take care of this, God. How come you don't just help me out here? Because, I mean, I got things going on. Well, because that's not the important thing right now, maybe, for you or me in those circumstances. And it wasn't the important thing for Job. Regardless of our circumstances, we need to have a right understanding of who God is and who we are in relationship to him. You know, Job finally got what he thought he wanted. God spoke to him. But as God always does, God told Job what he needed to hear and not what he wanted to hear. Now, when I showed you the picture of the billboards at the start of the message, this was the first one, right? Don't make me come down there. Now, probably most of you noticed that it wasn't quite right, was it? What should it say? Don't make me come down there again. Yeah, that's what it should say. Jesus Christ, God in the flesh, has already come down to earth once. But he didn't come to punish it. You know, it sounds like, you know, threat, right? Don't make me come. It's like parents talking to their kids. Don't you make me come down there. Don't you make me turn this car around. Whatever. Okay. Jesus came to earth, but he didn't come to punish us. He came to save us. And he's going to come down here again. And when that happens, the words of Matthew 25:46 will be fulfilled. And those who do not belong to Christ will go away to eternal punishment, while those who do belong to Christ will enter into eternal life. And do you belong to Christ? Now, for many of you, I'm going to get a confident yes, or absolutely, or you bet, or uh-huh, or whatever. You know. But for some of you, the answer may be, I'm not sure. Yeah? If that's your answer, and I ask you the question, do you belong to Christ? You say, well, maybe. Okay, that's not the answer I'm looking for. And I'd really like to talk to you about that, if that's your answer. Even more, if your answer to that question, do you belong to Christ? If your answer is no, then I would have to ask, well, do you want to? Do you want to belong to Christ? If you do, please come forward as we stand and sing our invitation song.